Session number 8258, Douglas Fairbanks, Jr., Part 1.
When did you first join the American Armed Forces?
I started taking training for the United States Naval Reserve in, I think it was 1940, shortly after war broke out in 39. And then I had a lot of civilian work to do. I passed my examinations after several months of training, got my commission either at the end of 40, beginning of 41, but then was detached and sent by the president on a special confidential mission to certain countries in Latin America, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile and Peru, on detached duty to the Office of the Presidency and the State Department. Then went back to the Navy again, was given some time off to complete my civilian obligations and professional commitments, and then went on duty. I think it was on active duty, went to sea as a very, very junior grade lieutenant, which is the only thing I could get at my age and training, and as low as I could get. I think it was the summer of 41. It was spring or summer, mid 41. And then I went to sea shortly after that, and was on destroyers, because as you may or may not know, the U.S. Navy was, what you might say, at war, although the U.S. government was not. We had, President Roosevelt had declared about two-thirds or three-quarters of the Atlantic as being the neutrality zone. And so American ships were joining with Canadian and British ships in escorting convoys across the Atlantic. And so we had several engagements with U-boats, and several of our ships were sunk, and battles with U-boats. But it was not considered actual war by the government of the United States. So I was on that duty, destroyer escort duty to convoys, for that period. And then, do you care about the rest?
Yes, if you would, please.
Yes, all right. From there, let me see, I was temporarily sent back to Washington for duty at Naval Headquarters in Washington, at the Commander-in-Chief's office, sent out for some instruction for about a month or 6 weeks in minesweeping off the Atlantic coast. They thought that was enough of that, and I was sent off to Scapa Flow to go on the staff of the commander of what was known as Task Force 99, which in turn was attached to the British Home Fleet. And we had quite a number of ships. We had a great big battleship, the USS Washington, which was one of the biggest we had at that time, aircraft carrier Wasp, several cruisers, and many, many destroyers. And I was named as flag lieutenant and assistant communications and assistant gunnery officer on the staff. When on the destroyer earlier on, I was put on watch duties and also assistant communications. I was on communications and deciphering, and was learning the job of assistant gunnery officer as well. So by the time I joined the staff of the commander of Task Force 99, Admiral Giffen, by that time I'd learned my job reasonably well, because I'd had accumulated quite a lot of experience on destroyers and also in getting my commission in the first place. And then the Admiral thought it was a good idea for me to present him with and the Navy and the historical side of naval archives, with a report of certain operations which he and the flagship were not attending. For example, we were asked to join with the British in delivering aircraft to the island of Malta in the Mediterranean. And so, in company with HMS Eagle, and I forget another carrier as well, the U.S. dispatched the USS Wasp, quite a large carrier at that time, together with several of our destroyer escorts, on a convoy down to Malta. And we had to stop in Glasgow and load up the planes with RAF personnel who had been trained to fly on and off carriers. And then we went in convoy down to the Mediterranean. The Eagle was sunk subsequently. The Wasp had made two trips of that nature. On the second one, we got an amusing signal from the Prime Minister, from Churchill, saying, "Who said a wasp couldn't sting twice?" Which amused us all. Very gratifying. And so then I prepared a long report on the operation for the Admiral, and at the same time doubled up as being the Admiral's representative, along with a captain on his staff, in advising on communications and gunnery on that convoy. I then had the same job assigned to me for convoys to Murmansk, Russia, and was on detached duty to one of our light cruisers, the USS Wichita, which was in a section of the convoy called the Close Covering Escort. And the most disastrous of the convoys, I happened to have been on that one, which was known as PQ-17. A great many books have been written about it. And we had a tremendous amount of losses, I think. I forget the exact number, but it was something like 38 out of 44 ships, or something of that nature. Tremendous amount. And it was quite a scandal afterwards. The Germans claimed to have sunk all the convoy, and they were very nearly right. But we didn't admit any losses till after the war. That was mostly in the merchant ships. There were a great many recriminations afterwards. Was it necessary to instruct the convoy to scatter, which the Admiralty did, on receiving intelligence that two of the German battleships had been on the way? I think it was the Scheer and the Lutzow. Not quite certain of the names. I'd have to look them up at the moment. Were on their way out of Norwegian ports and headed for us. We did have an enormous amount of the British Home Fleet and the U.S. Task Force waiting for them off the north of Iceland, hoping to bring out the German fleet, but they were too far away, had the report been true. And so the Admiralty, just discovering this, and just reading of this intelligence, told us all to scatter, which turned out to be a very bad misjudgment of what was happening at the time. And the Germans were able to pick off the ships one at a time, with both from wolf packs of submarines and also continuous air bombing night and day, because we were in the way, way up north in the Arctic Circle in July of 1942. And so we had the midnight sun, so it went on day and night for several days. And so that was pretty awful. And when we came back, there were a great number of who was to blame, and quite a lot of ill will developed as a result of that, but which finally got sorted out. But even the top-ranking officers of both navies blamed the Admiralty and possibly also the U.S. Navy Department, to a lesser degree, for this decision to scatter, because up to that moment we thought we had the thing pretty well under control and we could have made Murmansk. Actually, the Russians were supposed to come over and join us and help us to get in and overlap with us. And when the trouble started, they didn't come. They just stayed in port. And that was also a reason for further recriminations against them, and we just left up there, and everybody scattering in the poor convoy was just picked off. At a time when you could only stay in the water about 15 minutes and stay alive, because the water was so cold, and you weren't allowed to pick up survivors, because it would endanger your own ship, and the only ones who could survive were those who made lifeboats or rafts, but if they got individually into the water, you had to give them up.
Did your ship actually bypass survivors?
Did we what?
Did you actually bypass survivors on your ship?
From a distance, not very close. But from a distance, I mean, we could have gone and picked them up had we been allowed to. But it would have put in danger an enormous cruiser with, 1,500 others on board, pick up maybe two or three survivors. And a very modern ship. One of our scout planes got lost because of being so far north, compasses went out of whack, and he just kept disappearing, never found his way back. He couldn't.
How did the fate of the convoy affect morale as far as you observed it?
Oh, it was terrible. Absolutely awful. Very, very low. And everybody blaming everybody else. British blame the Americans, Americans blame the British. British and Americans together blame the Admiralty, and the Admiralty blame the Navy Department. Navy Department blame the Admiralty. It was awful. The ultimate blame rested with the Admiralty in London, who made a false assessment on the basis of information, of intelligence, which was an error. And so several books, the most important of which were written by Captain Broome, RN, on the subject. And it's pretty shocking stuff. But, of course, nobody did it deliberately, but it was... it was a decision that was made hurriedly without checking with those on the spot. We on the spot were quite confident that we could have handled the whole thing quite well, and we were handling it all pretty well at that time. And it turned out that the German ships were not on the way out at all.
So the feeling on the ship was of some surprise when you received the order to scatter, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yes. And then it was weeks before we could sort of settle down. We had to make our way back to Iceland, and it was a long time before we got the full story, and I had to write a report on that as well. And it's my report's in the archives of the Navy Department at the moment, and parts of it have been quoted in various histories of PQ-17.
Did you at any time actually land at Murmansk?
No, we never were allowed to get that far. Some of the merchant ships did that survived, a few of them. And one or two of the British destroyers on another convoy went, but the sailors were not allowed ashore. The Russians didn't allow them ashore after these terrible voyages. The winter convoys were terrible because of the weather. And you can imagine these mountainous seas and terrible climatic and oceanic problems that would be met during the winter months. And the summer months, where all was calm, were equally terrible, because that was when the enemy was able to attack 24 hours a day with the everlasting sun.
Which season did the naval personnel actually prefer, the summer or the winter?
What is that?
The naval personnel, did they prefer the summer or the winter?
Neither one. I suppose... the worst of part of the winter was just the physical discomfort and bashing back and forth and no sleep day or night that you could get, and just tossing and turning and twisting and shipping water and terrible storms. As opposed to calm seas, good weather, and being in battle 24 hours a day. Night and day with the midnight sun. So I mean, it's difficult to choose.
What were there any special precautions you could take against the cold?
Not really. I just dressed as warmly as you could, and they provided a lot of things to keep warm. Of course, the inside the ship was quite warm. It was, when you were on deck, pretty cold. Summer, it wasn't all that cold. I mean, it was cold by normal standards, but it wasn't all that cold.
Did people actually suffer from frostbite?
No, I didn't, no.
Did you know of anybody?
Some of the aviators who took off their gloves would have. But I didn't... Well, yes, I was up in that area in Iceland anyway during winter months. And that was cold, but it was a sort of damp cold. It didn't get the frostbite you'd get. The airmen would get frostbite, sometimes getting up in that terribly dry, freezing cold in the air if they took off their gloves. I almost did on a trip once to Iceland by air, or if you were in the water. But otherwise, I don't know of any other case.
What did you do after the Russian convoys?
Well, then, by that time, Admiral Mountbatten had been assigned to be the chief of combined operations, and he had requested the American admiral, who was resident here in London and was commanding U.S. naval forces in Europe, Admiral Stark, I think it was, if he could have some representative American officers to study how combined operations worked, so that in due course the U.S. forces, Army and Navy, Air Force, could possibly develop a similar organization, which in due course we did. It was called something else, though. The Army, they were called Rangers instead of Commandos. And there was no actual special operation, no combined operations command as such, but we did develop units which fulfilled many of the same functions. And whenever combined operations were required abroad, either in the European theater or even later on in the Pacific theater, the British combined operations absorbed many of the American units to carry out some of their objectives at the same time, and were destined to carry out more when the Japanese surrender came. Excuse me. All right. And so I'd been in constant communication with Lord Mountbatten for months, as he'd been an old family friend, and he and his wife had spent their honeymoon with my family when they were first married, and they were godparents of a couple of our children. And so he thought it'd be nice to ask if I could be assigned. He wrote and asked me, and I said, yes, of course, I'd love it. And was rather anxious to get in from the sea. I'd been at sea then for 2 or 3 years, except for brief breaks and leave here and there on both sides, both back in the States and in the UK. And it had quite enough shooting for a while. If I could get out of it, I thought a nice job on the staff of combined operations would be fine. And so I was asked to be one of those detached from the home fleet and sent down to London for instruction, and eventually to be absorbed within the combined operations command. That I did, and enjoyed being back in London immensely. And also was delighted to be part of this very hush-hush organization, which it was then, which I thought very exciting, and to be on shore for a while. To cut a long story short, I was assigned to various departments within Combined Ops, the intelligence, the planning, then camouflage, then various developments they were doing in the way of sonic deception and visual deception, playing records and recordings of various kinds of tanks, doing every kind of trick to deceive the enemy in tactical operations. And then Lord Mountbatten decided that I was recognized from time to time as coming into Richmond Terrace, where the headquarters were. And as it was such a secret organization at that time, I was an embarrassment to them. I was compromising. People would say, well, what's he doing here, and what's he going to do, and what is that in there? So he eventually decided to send me away, which I didn't like at all. I was having much too much fun. But to go up to Scotland, to Inverary, which was the commando training headquarters, or one of them anyway, to learn the physical side of the commandos. Although I was a naval officer, and most of them were army, there were some navy there. So I spent a few weeks in that training center there, and again I was a problem because of recognition. And he said the next thing would be I would have to be in operations themselves, and that would be a complete breakaway, and I would go down and have instruction in the command of a flotilla of raiding craft down near Southampton. I think it was in Wasatch, where there was several flotillas of these raiding craft, where naval and Royal Marine and Army units, all under commando or combined operations command, were training and rehearsing and operating for various operations that they had in mind. And so I stayed there, not wanting to go there at all. And I tried to get out of it, as a matter of fact. And I said to Mountbatten, "Oh, I can't do this. I'm an American officer, and the British personnel in the Royal Navy or the Royal Marines or the Army needn't pay any attention to any order I might give them." And so all he did was laugh and said, "We'll cross that bridge when you come to it." And the next thing I knew, I was learning and commanding a flotilla of raiding craft.
Did being an American cause any problems in the...
No. But I always kept hoping somebody would interrupt and say, "To hell with it. I'm not going to do anything you say." And so we operated out of there, and then sometimes out of New Haven on the other side. And I only went on a couple of small raids and some deception raids, where we tried to scare them up with noises, testing sonic equipment and radar and radio equipment. And then one little raid on the... a semi-raid on one of the Channel Islands.
What did that involve?
Not really much. Hardly anything. More or less an exercise, what it amounted to. And by that time, I was being asked to return to the United States and teach our Navy how these raiding craft, amphibious raiding craft, operated under combined ops, and to develop our own special operations group with this sonic deception. We had made recordings of all kinds of sounds and noises, of tanks landing, of communications between ships, to be played over water behind smoke screens, and to give the illusion to those on land that there was a great big landing going on. And they seemed to work perfectly. The reaction on the enemy was quite fantastic when we would experiment. It was something that had begun in the Mediterranean under a group called A-Force, which was completely devoted to deception of the enemy, either by radio and radar or by sonic deception. And during the battles on the Western Desert, they would come around by sea and carry out some of these operations. And I think that they were also working closely with the then long-range desert group, as well as the OSS and the SOE and the SAS, all those various groups. They would join up to execute some of these deception operations. And so it was my job to look for volunteers from various universities who could be commissioned and who were very knowledgeable in electronics and in science, and give them some quick training in naval procedure, as well as to lend their talents and knowledge to these new electronic devices. Then we'd mix that with our regular naval personnel to operate these small boats. And we had a secret group of ships, flotillas of ships, that operated sometimes with what the British would call MTBs and what we would call PT boats, with landing craft, and almost anything that served that particular operation. And we called them beach jumpers as a cover name. And they were highly knowledgeable in the world of communications and of deceiving the enemy in sending out false signals and creating a false impression of landings and operations on land. This was all coordinated with overall deception plans which had been created back at headquarters on a much larger strategic scale. And we would be made privy to these overall plans. And I had the double job of working on the planning side for these special operations and coordinating them with the British forces. I was then back to the staff of the American commander in the Mediterranean. By this time, we'd come back over here. And then linking that up with the army operations. And occasionally, we would be called upon to provide transport or assistance to the OSS or the SOE, who got most of their help from their own British forces. But it got rather mixed at times. We were pretty well integrated between the British and the Americans on a great many operations, not all the time, but a great many. And we had a unit operating for the invasion of Sicily, a whole squadron that was based in Tunis, although our planning headquarters was in Algiers, the base for the boats was in Tunis. We operated around the left flank of the invasion of Sicily. We carried on various operations around the small islands above Sicily. We had another group operating with the British commandos of the Dalmatian islands off Yugoslavia and assisting there, a little island called Vis, which was our main headquarters. We had quite a sizable deception operation during the invasion of Salerno, where our efforts were directed at creating not only a diversion, but to make the enemy think that we were going to land north of Naples as well as at Salerno. We succeeded for a few days. We actually captured some islands off the coast north of Naples in the group of the Pontine Islands, they were called, and the main one where there were some coastal defenses, I believe, as well as I can remember, and radar stations, and quite a sizable amount of German personnel were there, as well as Italians, and the island of Ventotene,